You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
I'm Danny Shapiro, and I am the only one uncovering family secrets. I was digging and digging for something that I couldn't have told you what it was. I knew there was a mystery. There was just something driving me, pushing me, that was kind of invisible, and that has a lot to do with the body of work that I've made. I had always written about secrets, but what I didn't know was that I was the secret.
Imagine growing up and not looking like the rest of your family, and having people make jokes like, "Where'd she come from?" or "She must be the milkman's daughter." Danny Shapiro, best-selling author and podcast host, took an ancestry DNA test at 54 years old and discovered that her family had been hiding a secret from her for her entire life. But what would you do if you found out that your father, the father who raised you, the father you adored, wasn't your father at all? Would you act as though nothing had changed and go on with your life, business as usual? Or would you start a podcast to help other people uncover their own family secrets?
Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they, too, had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Danny Shapiro, hello. How are you?
I'm doing well, Laura. Really happy to be here with you.
Yes, yes. And to anyone listening, this is actually our second conversation. We had a first conversation on a Friday the 13th, where it was the Murphy's Law of podcasts, and everything that could go wrong went wrong. Mm-hmm. And Danny has graciously agreed to come back. We didn't get through the whole interview, thankfully. So we're just starting again. And I'm so grateful. Thank you so much for doing this, Danny. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate you.
It's truly my pleasure.
So my question to you to start off with is, tell me the song that you'd be most likely to sing karaoke to.
Ooh. You know, I would say that shifts and changes over time. But okay. Right now, I would say the high women, I'm trying to remember the, well, it's going to be a problem if I can't remember the title of the song, isn't it?
Maybe. Scott can probably find it.
Usually they flash it up on the screen for you before you start singing, which is really
true. Yeah, that would be helpful.
Yeah. The high women.
It's that one where there's the kind of, just the chorus of all the different, the voices of women, like who are different characters over time. It's kind of a confessional, really beautiful song. I've been listening to it during times of COVID cooking.
Oh,
I've been in the kitchen a lot more.
Yeah.
It's kind of,
me too.
My husband and son said they could like figure out that I was in the process of making some kind of elaborate dinner when they would start hearing that soundtrack come on.
Right.
Oh, there
right.
You go.
I love that. And there are so many of us meaning Scott, who's been been in the kitchen cooking. He's the cook chef in our house. And
I am. I've had a rebirth of excitement for cooking.
But I do. I hear the music wafting upstairs along with the wonderful smells of whatever, the aroma of whatever he's making. It is a nice thing.
I'll tell you, my husband and Michael and I have been married for almost 24 years. And for 24 years, he's been telling me what a good cook he was. And I hadn't experienced that because, you know, we just were both working and not spending a lot of time in the kitchen and getting a lot of takeout or eating out. And then during the pandemic, a revelation is that he's actually a really good cook.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the first thing he made you that you went, wow?
I think it was a curry. I think it was maybe a shrimp curry or a chicken curry, but just good kitchen sense, you know, sense of, I don't particularly have that skill. I mean, I can really follow a recipe, but I don't have good kitchen sense. I get nervous about.
I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Scott just looked over at me because that's how I cook. I follow recipes and like, he just laughs at it to the T.
Yes.
I mean, if she can't find the quarter teaspoon,
then it's
the
done.
Meal stops right there.
Yes.
But he's more of an intuitive cook. And so
I got mad respect for Michael because he's your sound engineer and he's a good cook.
Right. You guys are twinning over there.
And 28 years. That's
24.
Awesome. Oh, 24.
Yeah. So thank you for that, Danny. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is the only one in the room. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So today we are talking to one of my literary sheroes, Danny Shapiro. Danny is the author of the instant New York Times bestselling memoir, Inheritance. Her other books include the memoirs Hourglass, Still Writing, Devotion, and Slow Motion, and 5 novels, including Black and White and Family History. Danny's podcast, Family Secrets, features stories from guests who, like Danny, have uncovered life-altering and long-hidden secrets from their family's past. So welcome, Danny. Welcome to The Only One in the Room. We're so happy to have you.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks, Scott. It's great to be with you both.
Yeah, thank you. And before we talk about Family Secrets and the podcast and your family secret, which you uncovered, I just wanted to acknowledge The Way We Live Now, which was another podcast that you did this year for 3 months, right? During COVID?
Yeah, I started it close to the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah. So it was a daily podcast. Brilliant, I thought, to do a podcast. You started in April. I believe. Is it like the beginning of April, I think. And you just talk to different people around the country about how they were living now. And you start off with the question of what they're looking at that moment, just to for us to set the scene of where they are. And the first one that I listened to was Omar. And he's a chef. He's a Black chef who had a thriving business that was really just, you know, I think he was in the New York Times and he was written up in different various places, and he did these culinary experiences for people and was really just getting started. And then COVID kind of shut him down, and you were talking to him somewhere else. But my son is a chef. He's a Black chef, and he had a business that got shut down at the beginning of COVID. So someone directed me to that. And I just loved it. And then I listened to KSA, and we have just interviewed him. So I was really excited that you interviewed him as well. And I loved your talk with him, and I just love that podcast. So I just wanted to give it a shout out, and people can go back and check it out, just because we're going into possibly another period where we'll be inside for a bit.
Oh, thank you for that. And that's true. I think that those stories are certainly... as relevant now as they were in April. And we couldn't have imagined that we would still be in a place where we needed to hear other people's stories because we were, you know, kind of sheltering in place or, you know, at home and in our little pods with either alone or with very few other people. But right. It was a great experience having those conversations and having those windows into people's lives. And, you know, and actually some of the people that I interviewed, like Omar, for example, Omar Tate, I've continued to follow, and he's in Philadelphia now, and he's trying to recreate or kind of create anew these kinds of dining experiences. You know, like he won't be shut down by this, you know, like there'll just be another way that he'll pop up and have, you know, I think the pandemic is changing so many of our lives in so many ways, but it's also a chance to take a moment and take a breath and reinvent, you know, being invention, being necessity, being the mother. What is that expression?
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah. And that's where we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, my son went to Postmates. Like that was his entire business, went to Postmates after he got shut down, and he's reinventing himself again now too. So yes, it is. I'm so glad to hear that Omar is continuing. And again, for anyone who's listening, just check those out. They're brilliant. They're not very long, and they are just perfect to reflect on what other people are doing while we're all doing kind of the same thing, mm-hmm. just in separate places. Danny, can you tell me how you identify?
Oh, she, hers.
Okay. Anything else?
You mean just kind of in the broader picture of the long list? Yeah. It's changed a bit in recent years, but I identify as a mother, as a wife, as a writer, as a teacher, as a memoirist, as a novelist, as an only child, as someone who grew up in an observant religious home, in a Jewish home.
Yes.
As more recently, as someone who discovered that she was donor conceived, and, you know, that my identity, genetic identity, ancestral identity, had actually been a secret, had been hidden from me for all of my life. And that has shaped and shifted to some degree the way that I identify, because it's kind of broadened it in a lot of ways. It's really a remarkable thing in midlife to find out that you're not exactly who you thought you were.
Right, right. I just love this story so much. And I want to just start off by talking about the first only one in the room that attracted me to you, was that you didn't look like you were Jewish, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. typically, if you think about a typical Jewish person, you just, in your community, and I think that you said in either in an interview or maybe I read it, people would say, like, did your mom have an affair with the Swedish milkman, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell me a little bit about that, what it was like to grow up this very blonde, fair person in an Orthodox Jewish home?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I've had a lot of people and a lot of readers say to me, you know, there are a lot of blonde, blue-eyed Jewish people. And of course there are. But I actually looked like I came from another part of the world entirely. I now can really understand what people were seeing when they were saying that, even though saying that is just something that nobody should ever say to anyone. You
right.
know, you don't look like X, Y, and Z. You don't look like who you say you are, who you think you are, or, you know, where you come from. It's a very othering, very, it's disturbing, especially to hear it as often as I did. And the result of that was a couple of things. One is I just dug in, you know, I just dug my heels in. And, you know, when people would say that to me, I would recite a long list of my, you know, family history and where my parents came from, right. and my grandparents. And
you were defending.
I was defending. Yeah. And also it kind of pissed me off, to be honest, because I felt on some level I understood that people were saying something to me
right.
that was dangerous and that was sort of, and also they meant it to be flattering. And that really bothered me because yes. that has a whiff of veiled anti-Semitism, or maybe not so veiled, because they meant it as a compliment that I didn't look Jewish. They meant you're a pretty blonde, blue-eyed, fair, you know, child or a young woman. And often, I should say, it was often Jewish people who were saying that to me. So it just was very confusing and it bothered me a lot. But it's the net result of it was that I felt that I didn't belong anywhere because I didn't feel that I belonged in my community. I didn't look like I belonged in my community. That was pointed out to me all the time. And I didn't know what to make of that because by everything that I did know about myself, I belonged. I would recite all my, Jewish cred, mm-hmm. And then,
yes.
But then this would continue to happen.
I so identify with that. And I, both my parents are Black and I'm Black, but all my life up until recently, when people have become more aware of the fact that it's not a compliment, people would compliment you by saying that I didn't, where were your ancestors from? Like, what do you mix with?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very clearly this woman at one of my first jobs looking at a modeling picture that I was, I was trying to model then, which didn't ever happen. But she looked at it and she's like,
we have that in common.
We do. We have so much
wow.
in common. And she said, oh, you don't even look Black here. This is beautiful. And I was just like, wow. So that's the standard for her, is that I'm so beautiful that I don't look Black.
Right.
Right. And
right.
Which meant that she was complimenting me to say that I looked more European in that
right.
in that photo. And it's really.
And how do you hold that? Like,
how do you hold that yeah.
as a child? How do you hold that as a young woman?
Yeah.
I mean, I had an experience just in the last couple of weeks that was really illustrated or underscored this to me in a big way. So it was just recently the Jewish high holidays. And I live a very assimilated life. I mean, I haven't actually spent any time in synagogue in many years, but it really is the fabric of my childhood. And so I always have, or, I increasingly, as I get older, have a kind of longing for it, even though I am not a religious person in the traditional sense.
Right.
And because of the pandemic this year, on the Jewish high holidays, if one wished to, one could join any service anywhere in the world. So I wasn't kind of stuck with the rural Connecticut possibilities, where I live. I could, just pick another synagogue and join their services on Zoom. And I have a dear friend who's a rabbi at a congregation in New York that if I lived in New York, I would attend. It's an inclusive, like deeply spiritual, activist, meditative, conscious kind of community. I just I've loved the time that I've spent there, but I live 2 hours outside New York. So I joined the Zoom on the high holidays, but because it was on Zoom, I had the option to keep my camera off.
Uh-huh.
And I chose that option. And so there were hundreds and hundreds of people on this Zoom call and I could see them, which was wonderful. And they were, the cantor was Asian and another one of the rabbis was, I believe, Asian, and there were people of every shape, color, size, gender in this glorious kind of tapestry of people. But I kept my camera off and I had a really profound experience. And I realized it was because no one was looking at me and having that thought.
Oh, wow.
Like I was protecting myself from even having the thought directed at me of like, wow, what's she doing here? And it was liberating.
Yeah.
And so I just offer that as an example because it's such a strange thing to be viewed in a certain way that is so kind of discomforting. And what do you do with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that scene. It's I can absolutely picture it and I can see why that would be comforting. My ex-husband is Jewish and my two boys went to a Jewish preschool. And I was worried that they would stand out and not fit in. And when we got there, I was like, oh, my God, they all look like them. They all had curly hair and kind of olivey skin. So my kids fit in perfectly. But a little girl like you would have stood out in that school. You would have been the one who would have been more other than my Black children, which is really interesting.
That is interesting.
Tell me, just in case someone doesn't know what it looks like to be raised Orthodox Jewish, can you just explain what that looks like, what that's like?
Yeah. I mean, well, my family was modern Orthodox, which means that the kind of Black hat Hasidic Orthodox that, that you might see in, you know, movies or, you know, on the streets of Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Yes. The women didn't wear wigs. Mm-hmm. The men didn't wear long beards and, you know, side curls. To look at my family, you would not have necessarily known that we were Orthodox Jews. My father was really the upholder of all of this and came from that kind of family. And so we kept kosher, both in our home and out of our home, which meant strict dietary laws, only a certain like meat that was slaughtered in a particular kind of way, similar to halal, and no mixing of dairy and meat. I mean, really no mixing, like two different dishwashers, two different sinks, areas in the refrigerator where things were kept really strictly separate, no shellfish, and then the upholding of the Sabbath. So every Saturday, Friday at dusk until Saturday at dusk was the Sabbath, and no driving, no working of any kind, no turning on or off lights, really not, you know, not much of anything other than going to synagogue and reading was fine, or, you know, taking a walk. But it was a very strict and very unusual upbringing because we weren't living in that kind of community. So we were a family that was not in lockstep with the world around us.
Right. Where was this that you grew up?
This was in Hillside, New Jersey, which is a suburb, like bedroom community of New York City.
Okay. That's pretty fantastic. I have known people who keep strict kosher and meat and dairy is separate, but I haven't actually been in anyone's home who's done that. And I have seen it in movies, you know, and that's been one of my main exposures to it. So this is how you grew up. One of my favorite things that you said, and I think you said it, I don't know where you said it. I've watched and read so much of you, but you said you were a kid who read under the covers with a flashlight and wrote letters full of lies to her friends, and you thought maybe you were a pathological liar.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all happening while you're living this outward life, but you're finding an escape in writing even then, right? Like you're able to kind of create another world. Is that the with all the lies that you were writing?
Yeah. And I think, you know, escape is really an apt word. I think from the time that I was really pretty young, I just longed, I yearned to get out. And, you know, I had the realization in the last few years, somebody asked me, you know, when did you realize that you weren't going to grow up and remain religious and live a religious life and marry a religious man? And I thought about it and I thought, I never thought I was going to do that. I don't think I could have articulated that as a kid.
Right.
And it would have felt like a betrayal of my father, but I never thought that. I didn't fit in. I didn't fit with my parents. I didn't fit in Hillside, New Jersey. I didn't fit in with the expectations of the kind of life that I was supposed to grow up and live. And I think that reading for me from a really early age was a beginning of that kind of sort of digging my way out of that place, even though I had no idea that it was possible to grow up and become a writer. I didn't know any writers. My parents didn't know any artists or writers. You know, the books on our shelves, it felt like, you know, they just magically appeared there. It just didn't, I mean, it didn't seem possible.
Right.
But reading and writing and kind of being a fantasist, I guess, you know, was the beginning of my way out.
I love that word, fantasist. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
This episode is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Hey, thank you for showing me how to use that Zoom feature that makes you look brighter and reduces under-eye circles.
Right.
But I was thinking, how do I do that in real life? I mean, eventually I am going to have to see people in person.
Very true, honey. So what about that new cream from Voyage AC, the one in the bathroom, the Photo Eye Cream?
Yeah, it's the Bulgarian Rose Phyto Eye Cream.
Ah, Phyto.
And that's perfect. It's made with organic oils and extracts that reduce puffiness and under-eye circles.
It says here it's also soothing and anti-aging as well.
It's so good, hun. Voyage AC is absolutely everything you need. Wonderful gifts, faux fur throws, beachwear, diffusers, clutches, beach bags, clothes, glamorous masks, hand sanitizer, and this gorgeous Bulgarian rose Phyto eye cream. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VOYAGEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all of our listeners. That is 10% off everything you buy.
Yep. All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Tell me about the relationship between you and your father.
I adored my father and felt adored by him as a child. He was a very warm, like deeply feeling, very human, big-hearted person with a big presence. And we had a real bond. We had a real soul connection. But, you know, his warmth more than anything, I think, is what I felt. I kind of basked for it and yearned for it in later years. In my teenage years, he started to kind of fade away a little bit. And as I kind of came of age and became, you know, a teenager and then a young woman, he kind of just started to vanish for reasons that I, you know, didn't entirely understand. I knew it had something to do with the fact that he was in a lot of physical pain. He had a bad back. He started taking a lot of prescription drugs. And so he became a little bit of a shadow figure for me until his early death in a car accident when I was 23.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I know a little bit about that vanishing. I'm 12 years in recovery, and I definitely felt myself doing that with my children the year before I got sober. And it certainly wasn't a choice, but it was, I mean, it was a choice, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do. You know what I mean? It was just something that was happening, and I didn't know how to do it differently then. So 23, this is a horrific car accident. Is it both your mom and your dad in the car? Okay. And your father dies then in the accident, or does he die later?
He died a few weeks later, but he never recovered.
He never recovered.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I can't even imagine that at 23, Danny.
Well, I was not exactly your model of a 23-year-old who was going to be able to handle something that huge. I was pretty messed up myself. I was drinking a lot. I had dropped out of college. I was in a relationship with a really inappropriate man who was much older than I was and married and, you know, like check every box of a bad idea.
Yeah.
There he was. And I was very, very much in his thrall, you know, and as you said, my mother was also in the accident and she was very badly injured and, you know, was not expected to survive even at the point 2 weeks after the accident, when my father died, her doctors were coming to me and saying, your mother is a very sick woman and she may not survive this. I mean, she insisted that the funeral be in the hospital so that she could attend. And so there were hundreds of people at this funeral with my mother in traction in her hospital bed in the middle of all of it.
Wow.
And I spent his funeral mostly keeping an eye on her. But it is, and I've written about this, and I mean, in a way, my first memoir, Slow Motion, is all about this, but it's a very complex and paradoxical idea that the worst thing that happens can be the transformative thing. Like that period of time in my life, I was either going to go under or I was going to rise. And I think, and I've thought about this a lot in all of the years since then, that my awareness that my father died worried about me. We weren't estranged remotely, but he was worried about me. He would have had to have been worried. If you were conscious, you would have been worried about me. Made me really want to turn things around and make him proud after the fact. And it was kind of almost magical thinking, but it worked for me. I started living my life with my moral compass for years being, what would my father want me to do here? I didn't yet have the, what do I want to do here? What do I think is right to do here? But what would dad want me to do? And it helped me to break up with the terrible boyfriend. I took care of my mother and helped her get back on her feet and, you know, change her life. And I went back to college. And that's really, I was writing before then, but that's when I started writing for my life. Like that's when I started. Also, I felt a story to tell.
Yes.
And I wasn't really ready to tell it, but it was the fire under me.
Yeah. You know, that's a source with a capital S. That's a higher power. What your fathers would want for you in those times, and being able to latch yourself onto that to get to the point where you can decide, this is what I like and this is what I want. But some people, like me, needed that stepping stone of something that would want better for me, you know, to get to a place where I want it better for myself. And yeah, I just really heard that in what you said. And I think that's so beautiful. What a beautiful tribute to him that you didn't take the other road that was possible, that you were that mire you were sinking into and you lifted yourself out.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many higher power moments or sacred moments during that time. Like I remember being 25 and I was still smoking cigarettes and And I smoked a lot of cigarettes. And one day I had just gotten a puppy pretty impulsively, from a pet store on Columbus Avenue. Right. This puppy spoke to me. I did everything wrong in the way that you should get a puppy, but he was a great dog. His name was Gus. He was a Yorkshire Terrier.
Oh.
And I was with Gus in Central Park, and he was, I had him on a long leash, and he was, sniffing around and playing, and I was sitting on a rock in the sun. And I just thought, I want to live. And I never picked up another cigarette. And just, there were just moments like that. It wasn't easy, but it was clear. And the other thing too is that I've been thinking a lot lately about, what saves us and what has saved me and what some of the gifts in my life have been. Because there's been a lot of hard things, but there have been a lot of gifts. And I had, a pretty difficult childhood, privileged, but pretty difficult in a lot of ways. But I always had the ability to identify the helpers, like Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
The helpers were all around me. And so whether it was my piano teacher or it was later one of my professors and then ultimately more than one of my professors in college and in graduate school, or then still later meeting some of the great, like when I was writing my memoir, Devotion, I ended up meeting and becoming friends with, and in some cases really close with, some of the great spiritual leaders of our time. And it's like I didn't go searching for them. It's more like I recognized them when they crossed my path.
Yeah, I love that.
And became purposeful,
yeah,
about those relationships. And that's been a lifesaver and a soul saver for me.
Yes, yes. I love that idea that there are these access points in my life, and somebody can walk through or pass me and I might not have the access, and it might be one of those spiritual teachers or leaders. And then when I've opened that access point and they walk by, it's not like I'm looking for them, but I do have that access then. And that's usually my work, the work that I consider to be spiritual work, prepares me for that. And it's not like a seeking, but it's a ready for when it happens, or a recognition, kind of like what you were saying. So thank you for that.
Mm, exactly.
I want to jump forward to age 54 when you take your ancestry test. And at this point, your mom has passed as well, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So, my mom passed when I was four, when I was 40.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, talk about an access point.
Yeah.
Or these moments where, I mean, I should say when I took that home DNA test, it was purely for recreational reasons. I wasn't even all that interested in it. It was my husband who was into it. He was curious about his own family history and thought, his father was still living, and he thought maybe, it would be interesting stuff to talk about with his dad. And he asked me if I wanted to do it too, and I did.
Right.
Thinking nothing of it,
right.
Despite the fact that I'd spent my life being told that I didn't look like I belonged in my family. There was no little whispering voice in the back of my head, nothing.
Yeah.
In fact, I forgot that I'd even taken the test. And when my results came back, they, in fairly short order, revealed to me that my dad had not been my biological father.
Wow. So I'm sorry to laugh, but it's just crazy,
yeah,
that here you are, this lovely little blonde girl who grows up into this lovely blonde woman, having been told all of her life that she looks different, and now to find out that you were different, right?
Well, and not only that, but I grew up to become a writer who, over the course of 9 books, was always writing about, whether in fiction or in nonfiction, in memoir, always writing about identity and secrets.
Yes.
Always,
yes,
writing about family secrets. From my really early novels to my first memoir to my next 2 novels. I mean, I was digging and digging for something that I couldn't have told you what it was, but I knew there was a mystery.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't mean that as in I knew that consciously there was a mystery. I mean, there was just something driving me, pushing me, that was kind of invisible, and that has a lot to do with the body of work that I've made.
Yes, yes.
And then there it was. You know, I had always written about secrets, but what I didn't know was that I was the secret.
So now you know this, and both your parents are gone. Who do you ask? Well, how do you explore this to find out what happened?
Well, I immediately started exploring. I felt like I was, like, both my husband and I went into just full-blown detective mode to try to understand whatever we possibly could. And one of the things that I've learned and that I find pretty amazing is that there were a couple of clues that, in light of this new information, in light of the fact that there it was in, you know, in the DNA, irrefutable scientific evidence that my father was not my biological father, and that my biological father was, I had no information about my biological father other than that anyone on Ancestry.com who I was connected to genetically was French, Irish, Swedish, German, English. But I did have a couple of clues, and one of those clues was a long ago conversation with my mother in which she had let me know that she didn't mean to. It sort of slipped out. And I write about this in the book, but she let me know that she and my father had had trouble conceiving me and had undergone fertility treatments. She made it very clear that it was the two of them together undergoing fertility treatments so that they could have their own biological child. She was very, very clear on that. So I never really thought anything of it beyond that. I just was aware that they had had, you know, that there had been a long road to my conception, one of the reasons why I ended up being an only child. But that conversation came back to me as if it was written on a scroll and tucked into, you know, a tiny little corner of my memory. And that scroll suddenly unfurled, and the conversation verbatim, I remembered it. And one of the things my mother had said was that the place that they went to get help in, you know, reproductive medicine was this institute in Philadelphia. She used the word institute. She said Philadelphia. And I knew in my bones that the story was not going to be that my mother had an affair. It was out that conversation that might have been the story that I would have leapt to, but it didn't really make sense. My parents had not been married very long. They were both older. They had really, you know, been through a lot before they found each other. They'd each had, you know, previous marriages. It just didn't make, like, my mother having an affair didn't make sense. You know, maybe later in their marriage, but not at that point. And so I knew that it must mean that my biological father had to have been a sperm donor. And so, and which is the most surreal experience to learn when you have always believed, you know, that you knew your parentage, to discover that you don't. It's not the fact of, you know, being donor conceived. It's the secrecy around it. I just really want to make that super clear, because some people think, well, what are you saying? Are you saying that that's all that matters? Biology and nature is all that matters. No, that's not what I'm saying. It's just that I spent 54 years not only not knowing this, but believing something very different in terms of my identity.
Absolutely.
So armed with just very little information except for what was on Ancestry.com and Philadelphia and Institute, we were able to zero in on that person, that young medical student who was now a 78-year-old retired physician who had donated sperm and who was my biological father. We were able to identify him within 36 hours.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I just want to interrupt you for a second because I have two questions for you. The first was, when your mother slipped and told you that, do you think that she wanted you to know on some level?
I've thought a lot about that. I really don't. I think what happened was, it was at a crowded reception. I was introducing my mother to a friend of mine, classmate of mine, actually. The date was the second anniversary of my father's death, and I had brought my mother with me because I didn't want her to be alone. So I remembered a lot about it. And my classmate friend who I introduced my mother to, my mother said, oh, nice to meet you. Where are you from? And my friend said, Philadelphia. And my mother just blurted out, oh, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia. Came out of her mouth because I think that she was triggered by the word Philadelphia on the second anniversary of my dad's death at this crowded reception. And it just, and the minute those words came out, if she could have waved a magic wand and stuffed them right back in, she would have.
Yeah. I mean, I can totally see that. So my second question is, can you describe for people who don't know what it was like to seek reproductive help in 19, it was the 60s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it,
mm-hmm.
it was the early 60s?
It was the early 60s.
Okay. Yeah. What it was like then and what the process was and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I learned a lot about it. I mean, so much of writing Inheritance was about research and trying to understand the world that my parents inhabited and the choices that they made and what they were told, because it was so important to me to try to learn as much as I could about what they knew and therefore how much of a secret they were keeping from me.
Yes.
You know, like how conscious were they? And what I learned is that, first of all, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a baby boom. You know, the Newsweek actually conducted a survey in which Americans were asked what the ideal number of children for a family would be, and 0% checked zero.
Like it was
having children. There was no childless by choice.
No.
There was no nothing like that. Plus, you have two people who are living a religious life where be fruitful and multiply is super important. And there was a tremendous amount of shame around infertility, particularly male infertility. And, you know, men who were sterile or otherwise, at least to some degree, infertile, it kind of was equated with impotence.
Yes.
With powerlessness.
Yes.
And so the doctors at that time and the scientists and, you know, the people involved in the medicalization of this went to great lengths to help couples who were seeking donor insemination to feel that it wasn't really happening. So a couple would be told this was a treatment. It's going to help boost your chances. What that treatment was very often in those days was that they would mix the donor sperm with the intended father's sperm. And they would tell the couple, go home and have sex, come in and do the procedure, go home and have sex again, you'll never really know.
Okay. Wow.
And they really created a field of, you know, this kind of gray area possibility, you'll never really know, maybe. And I was told later when I was doing my research that the scientist whose institute this was would, even if a man was completely sterile, would never tell him that. He always wanted the man to hold out the hope that the child was biologically his. And so what it did was it created a range of responses in the people who were the couples who, and oh, they were also, the couples were also told, go home and forget this ever happened. Don't tell anyone.
Wow.
Don't tell your friends. Don't tell your parents. Don't tell your siblings. No one will ever know. The child will never know. And it's better for everybody this way because what we don't know can't hurt us.
Right.
That was the thinking of the day. And, you know, one of the greatest challenges that I had in terms of my own emotional response to all this, because I was so, at first I felt so betrayed and angry and just how could something as fundamental as my own identity have been withheld from me? And, you know, I gave incorrect medical history all my life just on a practical level. I gave incorrect medical history for my son on a practical level. I was really angry.
Yeah.
And what I had to do was come to an understanding of what ethicists, bioethicists refer to as retrospective moral judgment, you know, like judging the past by the standards of the present.
Yes.
Is not like an ethically or really psychologically sound way of judging the past. The people in this story didn't have all the information that we have today.
Right.
And doctors were gods. You know, Jonas Salk had only recently, cured polio, discovered the vaccine. DNA was new in terms of its discovery.
Right.
So I had to imagine my parents as people before me, you know, which was a great gift because it actually, in the end, has given me a lot more compassion for both of them, but especially for my mother, with whom I had a really prickly relationship. I just thought, you know, like what she went through, what they both went through, and the idea that they would go home and quote unquote forget this ever happened.
Right.
I think my childhood was very much informed by that quote forgetting. I think that they did not hold it in their conscious minds what they had done. I think that they stuffed it away, especially my mother.
Yeah.
But then I came out, you know, ironically looking very, very much like my biological father, really looking not like my mom and certainly not like my dad.
Right.
And so they, all the times that I was told, you know, where'd you come from, little blondie? You
right.
don't look, you know, all those times my parents heard all that.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew, but there's knowing and then there's knowing. And this went, I think, to a deeper place than what we would refer to as denial. It went to, it was like, it was just so buried that I think it became something that could only leak into their behavior,
yes.
not be held consciously. I think the things we can hold consciously, we then, they don't have to become toxic and they don't have to leak, right? Because we can identify them and look at them. But when it's something that we're stuffing down and keeping secret, that's when it becomes really dangerous.
Oh, yeah. And I was just thinking while you were talking, how beautiful for your dad to see you and hear other people say those things about you and love you the way that he loved you.
Yeah, exactly.
And because of the bond you describe in Read Inheritance and, you know, listen to the podcast, but in the bond you describe with your father is enviable. Like, that's the daddy-daughter relationship. It was very special, the feeling I got about your relationship with him.
Yeah, and I, you know, and it's one of those lessons that, you know, such an unexpected journey for me. But, you know, when people, you know, the whole time I was on tour for the book, people would ask me, sometimes somewhat combatively, you know, what I was really saying about nature versus nurture, especially, I have to say, adoptive parents who felt threatened by thinking that what I was saying was that nature is more important than nurture, which is not something that I was ever saying. And in fact, you know, my response to that is my mother, with whom I do share a biological connection, she was my mother. She and I were like oil and water in many ways. There was a real disconnect between us. But she was my biological mother. That is a fact. My father, who, as it turns out, was not my biological father, is part of the fabric of everything that makes me me, and, you know, with whom I have a soul connection that has transcended death, has transcended the fact that he's been gone in my life longer than the time that we shared together. And it is true that I also have a biological father whom I favor, not just physically, but actually because I've had the opportunity to get to know him. We are actually very much alike.
Hmm.
It's bizarre. I mean, we have the same favorite novel. He's a very good writer.
Wow.
He's a thinker. He's a public speaker. He's a teacher. We have a similar kind of cadence, and our gestures are similar. And it's a very, very surreal thing to see that in someone who is essentially a stranger.
Yes.
You know, we did not share a life together. We will never share a life together. I'm fortunate, so fortunate, and more fortunate than many, many people in my position, that I've been able to get to know him and that I've been able to, you know, actually see this and experience this biological connection. But it's not, it doesn't make him my father.
Right, right. Wow. I love that you cleared that up, because I can completely see why people would be threatened by the idea of nature versus nurture, the way that you're telling your story. And then to have you say that so articulately, that soul connection with your father, which can't be denied, but neither can the similarities between you and your biological
exactly.
father. So those neither of those things need to be denied in order to exist, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the things that made me realize, and again, this is because of being on book tour and being kind of confronted by this on a daily basis for a year.
Yeah.
It just forced me really deeply into the questions, and as did writing the book, but being confronted in real time was just kind of, or being not, you know, interrogated, I guess is a better word.
Yeah.
I realized that the reason why so many of us are so threatened by this, you know, question of nature and nurture, or nature, you know, being overvalued, is because we believe that we can control nurture, and we know that we can't control nature.
Right.
I mean,
right.
you have more than one kid. I mean, mm-hmm. anyone who has more than one child knows that.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I have one child, and I still know that. You know, we are at the mercy of our natures to some degree, and we want to believe, especially as parents, that if only we do all the right things and we love in all the right ways and we expose our children to what we believe are our highest values and we educate them and we give them everything that we can, that everything will turn out, you know, according to plan.
Right, right.
And then that little pesky nature thing emerges. So I just realized that that was where I think a lot of the threat comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. We are just about out of time, which makes me very sad. I have one more question for you, and I just want to know that this, it might not be one more question, it might be two, but the first one is, what made you take your book and decide to tell other people's stories on your podcast?
That's a great question. So it was, my book was still in manuscript. I had finished it, and I was on the phone one day with a dear friend of mine who's a woman known to many. She's one of the gifts in my life, the great Buddhist teacher, Sylvia Boorstein, great mindfulness teacher and writer. And she was an early reader of mine, and I had sent her the manuscript. And we were talking about it afterwards, you know, after she had read it. And it prompted her to tell me the story of something that had been a family secret of hers. And I was on the other end of the phone, and I thought to myself, I wish I was recording this. It's such a beautiful story. And then when I hung up, I thought, podcast. I mean, I live in the country. I drive a lot. And so I had become, you know, a listener to particular podcasts. And I love great storytelling in a podcast. And so it happened in the most organic way. It wasn't like, ooh, this is a good idea. Nothing in my life has ever begun with, ooh, this is a good idea. It's come, it truly has come from like just this rising up kind of place. And so Sylvia actually is a guest on the first season of Family Secrets.
Okay.
And then, you know, I didn't think of it as a confessional podcast, or certainly not as a rubbernecking, like people's, you know, like telling people's, you know, stories. It is more like I wanted to think about, what does it mean to make these discoveries about secrets, and what is the other side of that? Where do we get to? What is the, I'll say one thing about that on my podcast, in every episode, whether it ends up in the final recording or not, I ask my guests, do you wish that you hadn't found this out? Every single time. And there is not one guest in now 40 episodes, 4 seasons, not one guest has said, yes, I wish I hadn't known.
Wow. Well, that's pretty amazing. You know, it's amazing that to me that this wasn't around before, because it feels like people need a place to tell this. And I was talking to a couple of friends of mine who know your work and hadn't listened to your podcast yet. Hopefully they've listened by now. And as soon as I told them what it was about, they both told me their family secrets.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's why she created this podcast, because
right.
everybody has one of these. Yeah.
Everyone does. And now more than ever, because the combination of DNA testing has revealed so much, so many different kinds of stories and relationships and, you know, relationships that people didn't know about. And the internet is like rocket fuel just poured on top of that.
Yes.
There's just, we're in the era of the end of the secret, I really believe.
Yeah, I do too. Things are being uncovered faster than we can even type them in sometimes. And then what we do with that information and how we process it is part of that beautiful work that you're doing on your podcast. That's the end of my questions. I actually have so many more. I have sheets of questions for you. And a lot of it is about your writing, but I might just have to write you an email and ask you those questions.
Please do. Please do.
You have a lot of upcoming events. You're speaking virtually. I looked at your website. So you have a lot of stuff coming up. Yeah.
She says with a sigh.
Yes. Yeah. Can you tell people where they can find you and look up your events and follow you and all of that?
Yeah. So the best place to follow me on social media is Instagram. I love Instagram and I'm pretty active on there,
but
not overwhelmingly so. And that is just Dani Writer. That's D-A-N-I Writer.
Okay.
And then my website is DaniShapiro.com. And on there are we keep it very much up to date in terms of events that I'm doing.
It is up to date because I looked you up a few times and it's always being updated. Whenever people hear this, they'll be able to go on and see where you're speaking.
Exactly.
Next. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I cannot thank you enough. I'm so glad that we made this happen, Dani Shapiro. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I so enjoyed this conversation, Laura.
Yeah, me too.
I'm going to go call my sister and ask her for some family secrets before it's too late.
Right. Well, that's the other thing is that, you know, she was kind of working. We didn't get to really talk about this, but you were working against the clock when you were looking, right? Because
anybody who knew anything was old.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael and I had a running joke where I would say, I don't want to call him. I'm too nervous, or I don't want to call her. And he'd say, he may be dead by Friday. Right. Okay.
Well, you know, and it's interesting how it begins to matter as you get older, too. You know, like I think personally, I'm 52. I have two kids and I want them to know more about their past and not hand down legends as opposed to.
Well, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I could so easily never have known this. And now, you know, I don't speak about this particular thing publicly, but, you know, my son has been able to meet his biological grandfather. They got along like a house on fire. I mean, but even if they hadn't, just to fill in that piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a gift, huh?
What a gift. What a gift. Yeah. Thank you, Dani. Thank you so much.
So my pleasure. And we are often in LA. So when life is like, and it resembles anything normal again, it would be nice to meet you. It does sound
lovely.
Like we have a lot to talk about.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
The Only One in the Room has brand new interviews for you every week. You won't want to miss our full episodes every Tuesday, Scott Talks on Wednesday, and our new Thursday series, The Now Normal. And twice per month, be sure to catch our 30-minute Sunday edition by subscribing to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Join our Only One in the Room Facebook group if you'd like to tell us about your Only One story. All of us at The Only One in the Room wish you safety and wellness.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.